This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In his book Man and Superman, George Bernard Shaw said, "He who can, does. He who cannot, teaches." But once in a while, there's an exception who proves the rule. Someone who can both do and teach. Kia ora, and welcome to Sightlines, your guide to the visual arts in and around Dunedin. I'm Sally McMillan, and this show is brought to you on behalf of the Dunedin Public Art Gallery Society. Michael Greaves is a well-respected Dunedin artist who graduated from the Dunedin School of Art in 2017 with a Masters of Fine Art with distinction. Predating his Masters, he also has a BA in Art History from Otago, a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting, and a Bachelor of Teaching. And he has been a teacher at the Dunedin School of Art for 21 years, currently the Principal Lecturer in Painting. But while Michael has seriously impressive academic credentials, today we're mainly talking to him about his parallel life and work as a practising artist. Michael, welcome to Sightlines.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you're well known in the New Zealand art world, both as an academic and as an artist, and in fact further afield as well, because before your exhibition earlier this year, All Systems Tend Towards Disorder, which we'll talk about, you've also exhibited overseas, including in Berlin and Melbourne, and your works are held in collections both here and overseas.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to be able to exhibit for 20 plus years. I think I've been painting for over 30. Also, the exhibition in December last year of work at the Ashburton Art Gallery was the most recent one prior to this. I have work in a number of collections in Australia, in Europe, in America, and here in New Zealand, in the Art House Trust collection, previously the James Wallace Trust.
Right. It's a really impressive rap sheet for, dare I say it, a boy from Dunedin, and I say that as a girl from Dunedin. You were born and educated here, and I want to ask you, Michael, how did you become an artist? Because very often we find that artists have an art pedigree, shall we say. What about you?
I grew up here in Dunedin with the limited opportunities that you have here, whilst we have an incredible history of art in Dunedin. My family, whilst not 100% interested in art, would always support me, but I was always taken to drawing and imaginative. I had quite a large imagination when I was a child. So I was lucky enough in my high school years to be introduced to a very famous New Zealand artist by a family friend who noticed that I was interested in painting. I didn't know who that artist was when he said, "Would you like to meet an artist?" He said, "I can take you to Graham Sidney's studio." And I said, "Okay, sure." I didn't know who that was.
Whatever.
Yeah. as a young teenager in Dunedin. And so I spent quite a bit of time with Graham over the years. He took four of us under his wing from pretty much from the local lads, Simon Richardson, Simon Kennedy, and Isaac Lukes. He taught me a lot about painting. So I came from an interest, but not really from an art pedigree family.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think you'd also had connection with another quite well-known Dunedin artist in the form of life drawing classes.
Yes. My parents supported me in what it is that I wanted to do. I had to get a special letter of request to attend life drawing classes when I was 16 years old at the Dunedin School of Art. There I met Lindsay Crooks, and Lindsay turned out to be quite instrumental in my going to art school. He provided me with a letter of recommendation. Back then, there was quite a significant rigmarole to get into art school, and I was lucky enough to have him as a mentor.
Handy guy to know. And I think in those days, there were a vast number of applicants for quite a small number of places.
Yeah, well, when I was at art school, which was in the mid-90s, there really were only three well-known and respected schools in New Zealand, from my understanding, Auckland, Christchurch and Dunedin. So to come to school, there were a lot of applicants. So there was some 350 applicants for 48 places. So your proposal and your portfolio was scrutinised quite heavily.
Yes. How many of those applicants were expected to make it, if you like, because I think I remember you telling me that when you started at art school, you were given some reasonably discouraging news that not all of you were going to become Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah, well, yeah, there was a realism back then. I feel that I was very lucky to be at art school in the time that I was. A lot of my colleagues from art school continuing to be practitioners today. Some with quite well-respected careers in New Zealand and abroad. But there was always an understanding. I don't know if it was a true understanding, but it was bandied around that there'd be only like 5% of us that was still making in 10 years after art school.
Was that discouraging for you, or did that sort of spur you on to become more determined?
It kind of was, but I think I was a little bit too young to realise the gravity of that. And I had to make. I always had to make. I still do. So I think irrespective of what it is that I ended up doing, I'd still be making paintings.
Yes. Mm. And did you have a grand plan of becoming an art teacher and an academic, or has that just sort of evolved through your career?
No, I didn't have a grand plan of becoming an art teacher.
Who does when they're 16 or 17?
Yeah,
well,
I was terribly shy growing up. I was not a public speaker or anything of the sort. I would always sit at the back of the classroom. So when I left art school, I was very much unsure of what my career was going to be or become. There's a history of teaching in my family. I don't know if I knew that so much, but I did move into teaching, as a lot of students do from art school, thinking about what it is that they want to do in the future. So it was never really on my plan. It just sort of happened that way. I ended up being okay at it. I have a special mention of Blair Kennedy from King's High School and Roy Armand from Logan Park, who mentored me through that period and gave me opportunities to expand my teaching career.
Both well-known people in the Dunedin education and art scene. So fast forwarding now, despite those initial reservations and concerns, you have now been a full-time artist and a teacher for over 20 years. Mm. And during that time, you've had many exhibitions. Most recently, as we said, we've talked about All Systems Tend Towards Disorder, which was at the Olga Gallery in February, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will have seen that. And the title of the exhibition was, as I understand it, a reference to the law of entropy and the concept that suggests that systems move from ordered to disordered states. And I think the title, Michael, sort of suggests that the works in the exhibition would perhaps have a dark, almost dystopian focus, but the suite of work was in fact very beautiful oil paintings of gardens. Please explain.
As life happens, you're faced with a whole bunch of hurdles along the way, and I've had quite significant ones in the last 5 years. I've recently had three surgeries, two spinal surgeries and a shoulder surgery, which has kind of thrown a little bit of a speed bump in my regular life, as you can say. But those pauses or those hiatuses and working where you're forced to take rest can actually be quite beneficial. I wasn't driving. I was walking a lot. I had a chance to sort of observe, and things that just came to me whilst I was observing were colour.
Yes.
Colour in the local surroundings in Dunedin. And I was fascinated by the 2 weeks in spring where everything in the ground cover just kind of explodes. I had no scheduled exhibitions I had to make. So I decided I'd make something that was a little bit irreverent, a little bit whimsical. It turned out to be quite a nice decision to make in the end.
And it's evolved from there. Tell us about the technique that you are using for this particular suite of paintings, because I think it's different to what you've previously done, and it's a consequence of some of the physical limitations that you now have.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that I was left with a birthday present post-surgery of some permanent nerve damage in my right arm. So when I was trying to make paintings the way that I used to, I would cramp up and it would be quite difficult to apply paint. So I ended up changing my method or my process of working, which is, it's kind of funny, it's kind of dauby, it's almost like impressionistic. It's like playing drums on the surface. That was quite a welcome surprise in the way that paint goes on a surface, and I'm very interested in the role that paint has in imaging a picture. So yes, these paintings were formed from that restriction, and I think restrictions are always great in developing a practice.
A happy evolution.
Yeah.
And of course, gardens, you've talked about, you know, going for more walks and observing what's around you and the colour and the spring growth. But is there an underlying theme, if you like, about gardens in this work? And tell us about that.
Yeah, well, we live in an age where I think there's a, how dare I say, a kind of aggravation of self or place. Gardens are an area of control. There's a great history in gardens that relate back to different, how do I say, philosophies of life, I suppose, if we think of Christchurch as a massive one. But what happens in gardens is, as much as we try and control them, they try and control us in some ways. And if we were to leave them, they would take over and do what it is that they wanted to. So these works were made up of cuts and scrapes and collisions of things that didn't actually exist by themselves in the space when I saw. But they reference a kind of a pretty picture, has a little bit more of a dark undertone of some disorder, yes. I suppose.
And is there an extension of that perhaps to the human condition?
Very much so, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you've got these gardens that are being trimmed and cultivated to the nth degree.
Mm.
And
but if you look closely, they are wounded.
Yeah.
The paint application is not smooth, it's not pristine, it's not perfect. There's a lot of mess involved. I love what Philip Guston said once. He said, you know, paintings are about that mess. They're about that beautiful mess. It's not about everything being perfect.
Mm. And the same, of course, goes for gardens and for the human condition, because I suppose, you know, we as humans, we follow these rules as part of the social contract. Mm. We prune ourselves, we cultivate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath all of that, perhaps we are also longing to break out and be disordered in the same way that plants will if left to their own devices.
Very much so. And I think a lot of us do that in our private lives anyways.
And is there a parallel there for you, speaking of private lives, in terms of your life essentially having changed in an instant, I guess, as a consequence of the things that led to your surgeries? Is that also reflected in a way in this body of work?
I think you're reminded very quickly of your own mortality. There's a disconnect between what your head thinks you can do and what your body can do. And I think it's a kind of a magic to fall into an imagination where you can take yourself away from that maybe pain in your life or feeling of stuntedness in some ways and lose yourself into a work. And I think that's why I go to the studio every day.
Yes. Because when you look at these works, and for the benefit of listeners, obviously we don't have pictures because we're on the radio, but, you know, the skies in these paintings are almost apocalyptic. The trees have a kind of almost sinister quality. The flowers in the red spectrum, I think you've said they can be seen as almost wound-like. But if you look at the picture only superficially, you don't necessarily see any of those things. You see this very pretty, quite ordered, colourful, very pleasing to the eye.
It's the beauty of suggestion in painting. I have to pay great thanks to Kari Schmidt for the essay that she wrote accompanying the work. We talked a lot about the yellow sky as being apocalyptic, and I see it as being claustrophobic. It wants to keep your eye inside the image, otherwise it would disappear outside of the painting. It's an interesting one. I think suggestion is really, really important in painting. It leaves the viewer some space to enter the work themselves.
Yes, yeah. I'm here with Michael Greaves. Stay with us for Snapshot, our rundown of what's on in the Dunedin's art scene. But let's hear more about Michael's work. You've said that there have been two hiatus periods in your career as an artist, one after your son was born and the second after your surgeries. Did you find yourself with a burst of creative energy after having those breaks?
The first hiatus, not so much. I was more focused on raising a human. The second one, yes. The second one, I had a huge burst of creativity after. The work that I showed in Ashburton last year, Falling, if Not Flying, was about Icarus and Daedalus. And there was a huge burst of creativity in terms of a project that I wanted to get done in that space. It was very It was very daunting and quite endurance-based, that body of work. But I think the process of moving through painting without having any outcome associated, no show associated, led me to some creative enterprise that I didn't really have prior.
Yes, yeah. Michael, you've talked about the idea that there's nothing new in the world, and I think that's probably a bit challenged in an age where increasingly we view new images via an electronic medium. What do you say to the idea that technology does now, in fact, enable the creation of new images?
Yeah, it's a curious question. I find a lot of the students that I teach at school will come to school with a definitive idea of what painting might be, which often comes from looking at images, either in books or on their phones, on their devices or screens. And these are monocular and mechanistic. And the camera has a single point of vanishing. It reminds me of early Quattrocento paintings, or High Renaissance paintings, where perspective was a key element to representing a world of sensation. I think that there's a different way of experiencing the world, and I'll try and challenge students to live within their space or in their body. One thing I do with them, or I've done with them, is I will ask them to disintegrate themselves from those digital devices and take a walk with me. And they don't really know what it is that they're doing.
How does that go for you?
It's quite interesting. Sometimes I get a little bit of a pushback, but when we come to the discussion about it at the end, so if I can just explain to you, I used to, with my first year students, provide them with a piece of paper. It used to say, don't talk to me, don't talk to your friends, turn off your phone, and when I stand up, stand up. And when I walk, follow, and leave a little bit of gap between yourselves. And don't talk. And we go on a walk around the campus for about 45 minutes. And then when we got back to the studio, I would give them a piece of paper and say, now draw your experience. And this would throw them a lot because they were like, what am I supposed to draw? It's not a minute capture of experience. It shows that there's a time gap in painting. And there is a time gap in painting from when you start to when you finish. When you look at it, you see it all at once. So some students would start thinking about the color green, the different greens they saw. Others would think about the temperature on their skin. Some would think about light reflected off windows. And then we had a conversation about, well, how do we reference these in painting? How do we engage these in a world of painting when we think outside of the idea of painting as being a static image? Now, with digital devices and AI, I suppose, students have a real challenge to try and compete with digital images. But they have a sense of, as I said before, suggestion or embodiment, which is really, really important in painting.
Yes, yeah. Does it create an issue too about what is actually real art? Because now, of course, you know, there's been so much imagery, I hesitate to call it all art, imagery created by AI. And what's valuable?
I think what I find now is there's a tendency towards engagement with the maker, as well as the thing we're looking at. I find that's become quite important. I definitely hold it in a high esteem that you have a reference to the story of the making and the person that was making it as well. You get a chance for the small time that you're looking at the work to kind of stand in their space.
Yes.
It's very important.
Talking about your students and the future, I suppose, that you give them through the education that you provide, Michael. But what about your own future? What's in the pipeline for you currently?
At the moment, I'm in the process of potentially shifting studios. Still in the process of making mine. So there's going to be a small pop-up exhibition in the Dowling Street space on June the 12th.
Put that in your diaries, listeners.
With Linda Cook and Thomas Lord. And then it's continuing to make a new body of work from the garden paintings.
Well, fans of your work will be looking forward to the product of what comes next to you, and we'll be keeping an eye out for that exhibition. But in the meantime, where can people find your work for purchase?
So in Dunedin at Olga Gallery and in Auckland at Melanie Roger Gallery.
Okay. Michael, thank you for being with us today and giving listeners an insight into your life and your work as an artist and art academic. And now here's Ross Curry and Linda Cook with the latest on what's happening in the local art scene. This is Snapshot.
Linda, we should discuss the amazing new exhibition at DPAG, which is a display from the collection in conjunction with a new book publication, Te Ahi Kārua.
Yeah, an amazing exhibition, Ross. One worthy of a repeat visit. My favourite work in the whole exhibition is Saskia Lake's painting Early Telepas. This was exhibited at her solo show in 2019. What about you, Ross? What was your favourite?
Well, I really enjoyed Saskia Leek's painting as well. It's kind of delicate and strong at the same time. Sure. But I was excited to see in the flesh a painting by R.N. Field. And he was recruited to the School of Art in 1925 through the Royal College of Art in London.
There's a new exhibition on at DPAG, Imogen Taylor's work. I'm looking forward to seeing this. One of her paintings was purchased by our society's funds. I remember her wonderful exhibition following her year as a Hodgkins Fellow here in Dunedin.
But this month we look beyond Dunedin if you happen to be going north. The newly expanded Forrester Gallery in Oamaru is now open. And to mark this milestone, there's a collaborative exhibition by the Paimanu Naitahu Collective, Karaka Karaka. The Forrester welcomes back this exhibition, first shown at the Queensland Gallery of Modern Art, where it was a part of the Asian Triennial of Contemporary Art. And a show of Pacific textiles and art also goes through May. And of course, the new Oamaru tartan is on display. Linda, your art is small scale, and this month in Dunedin we have large scale at the Hocken and the huge Rhys King canvases and small scale work at RDS.
Incidentally, DPAG Society have a planned talk at the Hocken in June, guided by Nick Austin, a former Francis Hodgkins Fellow.
Well, the RDS Gallery has a group show of small art. It acknowledges that the bigger the work of art, the higher the price, resulting in some art being actually unaffordable. Some Dunedin artists featured in the Small Art Project include, amongst others, Bridie Loney, Inga Dosberg, Robert Scott, Justin Spears, and Nishima Sharma. And this show finishes on May the 23rd.
Also in town is De Novo showing Anita De Soto's works, She Doesn't Fit the Frame. This is on till 14th of May, so not long to get to that. This is a collection of miniature floral portraits and seascapes from her 25 Margaret Stoddard Artist Residency. And at the Artist's Room on Downing Street, there's a joint show by printmaker Al Bell and sculptor Matt Goldie. I do love a joint show, and it sounds like an interesting mix.
It certainly does, Linda. Lots going on.
Thanks, Ross and Linda, and thanks to you, our listeners. If you'd like to hear today's show again or listen to previous shows, you can find us on the Otago Access Radio and DPAG Society websites or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to join the Society, you can also find a form on our website or join at the DPAG reception. Thanks to contributors Ross Curry and Linda Cook, and to producer and DPAG Society President Jonathan Quayoff. Join us again next month for another dive into the visual arts in Dunedin and beyond. I'm Sally McMillan, and you've been listening to Sightlines.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.